I next met with Dr. Philip, who along with Dr. Andrew Koh discussed management of pancreatic cancer, and Dr. Philip also commented on new developments in management of hepatocellular cancer, as discussed in the symposium by Drs. Katie Kelly and Andrew Zhu. To begin, Dr. Philip discussed perhaps the most important new GI cancer data set presented at ASCO, the Phase 3 PRODIGE 24 trial comparing adjuvant modified FOLFIRINOX to gemcitabine in patients with resected pancreatic cancer. About two-thirds of the audience said they used capecitabine combined with gemcitabine as their standard adjuvant treatment, but as discussed by Dr. Philip, because of these new data, that is likely to change.
At ASCO this year, we had the results of the French trial, which was looking into FOLFIRINOX versus gemcitabine in patients who have resected pancreatic cancer. There were several important points about this trial, which is important for our day-to-day practice in terms of how we choose the patients and which patients may go into such a treatment, FOLFIRINOX. I have to start, Neil, with saying that the FOLFIRINOX dose they used is a modified dose. When I mean modified, it's really modified because the bolus 5-FU did not show up, but also after treating a number of patients, they realized that they had to reduce the dose of the irinotecan from 180 to 150 milligram per meter squared. And in 60% of their patients, they still needed to use growth factors, GCSF-based growth factors. So it's a treatment that still has a significant degree of side effects. However, they were able to show that with this treatment, they have prolonged the median survival to beyond 50 months. This was really remarkable. If you remember, there was one other study a few years ago with the S1, the Japanese did, and that showed a remarkable improvement in survival. This one really surpassed that. So a significant improvement in the median survival to beyond 50 months. The primary endpoint of this trial, however, was disease-free survival, which was almost doubled by the use of FOLFIRINOX versus gemcitabine alone. The median for gemcitabine was just over 1 year, which is what we have seen in prior studies, but in this trial it was doubled to close to 2 years. So certainly a positive trial that will impact our day-to-day practice. However, reading in between the lines, you understand that this is a heavy-going treatment, and this is a highly selected population of patients. These patients had to have no history of diarrhea or significant diarrhea after surgery. Their performance status should have been 0 or 1. Day 21 CA19-9 should have been 180 or less. So it was a selected population of patients. And the same argument that we have with advanced disease, patients who go on FOLFIRINOX should be really patients with favorable disease condition, oral condition, including the performance status. It's also noteworthy that when they set a mark of dose intensity of 0.7, in fact, it was a 50-50 chance that patients will be able to do that. So a significant number of patients either required dose reduction, dose delay, or even early discontinuation of the treatment. In fact, the patients who stopped the treatment early due to toxicity or other related issues were 20% or less, but certainly it was different than the gemcitabine arm, which was better tolerated as we would expect. So based on the results of this trial, in my own practice, in patients who have undergone resection of a pancreatic tumor, including R1 resection, R0 or R1, whether they have lymph nodes or low lymph nodes, they're recovering well from the surgery, and I have a window of 12 weeks as per the protocol, I will consider giving them the modified FOLFIRINOX the way it was given in the clinical trial. And I would also consider adding a growth factor to the regimen. And again, just to remind you that the treatment was given for 12 cycles. So it's a 6-month treatment. Again, something else in this trial, they did not include radiation therapy. So there was only a chemotherapy treatment for 12 cycles. That was a planned treatment.
And just to emphasize the actual data, the hazard ratio for disease-free survival is 0.58, 42% relative risk reduction, and the hazard ratio for survival was 0.64, 36% reduction. But what about the fact that the control arm was gemcitabine? Since the trial was started, gemcitabine plus capecitabine seems like it's become sort of the standard. Any way to indirectly compare how much benefit FOLFIRINOX would have compared to gem-cape?
So if I look back at the gemcitabine, capecitabine versus gemcitabine, I personally, I'm not seeing here a major benefit from using the capecitabine over the gemcitabine. And if someone who has a good performance status, I'll be switching to the FOLFIRINOX rather than gemcitabine, capecitabine. One of the interesting things is that even in patients who had the gemcitabine, the survival of the gemcitabine arm was also longer than what we have seen with prior gemcitabine-only treatments. And we think that now we're seeing the effect of subsequent therapies in patients who undergo one line of treatment, in this case gemcitabine, and when they have a relapse or progression, there is opportunity for other lines of treatment. So overall, we're pushing the survival of patients who have resectable disease.
That's interesting. You mentioned radiation therapy. In what situations, if any, do you utilize that in the post-op situation?
So a couple of points about radiation therapy. We're still waiting for the results of the RTOG trial, but that would be a bit of a wait because we still have maybe a couple of years before we have the results. But in the meantime, in my practice at least, I will use radiation therapy in patients who have bulky nodal involvement, pathological, that is, after the surgery. In patients who have R1 resection, I would use radiotherapy, but I will not be using radiotherapy in all patients. The other thing about radiotherapy is that I will combine radiotherapy with capecitabine. And in my practice, I will give the radiotherapy and the capecitabine like we're doing in the RTOG trial, finishing all the chemotherapy and then giving the radiation treatment. Doing it that way will make sure that there's no interruption in the systemic therapy that's now becoming more important. But also at the same time, if the patient experiences any disease progression or relapse outside of the pancreas area or pancreatic bed, then obviously radiation will not be necessary. And the way we do it is obviously we restage them. The French trial did the restaging every 3 months, and I think that's reasonable to do a halfway restaging after 3 months of starting treatment and then at the end of the treatment. And if you're thinking of giving radiotherapy, then you have to make sure that your patient is free from any distant metastases.
What about gem-nab in the adjuvant setting? Where are we in terms of trials on that question? And if a patient asks you about it, would you consider giving it off protocol?
So the clinical trial, which is looking into gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, is called the APAC trial, which included more than 800 patients. It was completed accrual, the primary endpoint being disease-free survival. The results of that trial are not out there, maybe end of this year, maybe next year. But in the meantime, at this juncture, I am not using gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel off protocol. Maybe I've used it in a couple of patients or three patients with varying circumstances, but it's not a routine consideration for me. I personally think that it's not a combination that is likely to be negative because of the nature of the drugs, but still we have to wait for the phase 3 trial. So the bottom line is that, yes, it's a potential combination to use, but it shouldn't be considered as a routine combination to think of in this disease when we have other potential options. And at this time, we have to wait for the result of the phase 3 trial.
So let's talk a little bit about neoadjuvant therapy, particularly in patients with borderline resectability. What about choice of neoadjuvant regimen? A lot of people will turn to FOLFIRINOX or modified FOLFIRINOX. You were talking in the symposium about using gem-nab in the neoadjuvant situation. How do you decide?
So the reason why we mentioned FOLFIRINOX, because the pilot studies and the one national pilot trial that was done in borderline resectable disease that was recently published, it's a FOLFIRINOX-based trial. So there has been experience with FOLFIRINOX at the nationwide level, and people have felt some degree of comfort with it. Surgeons are more familiar with it than the gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel. Remember, gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel came at a later date as a regimen in metastatic disease. The issue here is that what people think would be a regimen that produces a more regression of the tumor or a better objective response rate, if you look at the perception, it is that FOLFIRINOX produces maybe more of the objective response rate, and this is what you're trying to do, part of what you're trying to do in the neoadjuvant setting. For that reason, people have been more in favor of using the FOLFIRINOX regimen. However, if you look at the metastatic disease, the differences in response rate, yes, it may favor FOLFIRINOX, but it's not a huge difference. However, the whole issue of the choice of the neoadjuvant treatment will be hopefully settled by the SWOG trial that I referred to earlier, which is looking at the FOLFIRINOX versus gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel. Here, again, we're trying to look into not only the regression of the tumor, but how much does it really impact on surgery, surgical complications, and ultimately, what is the disease-free survival? Is it really even if you have more shrinkage maybe with one regimen, but overall, is it going to be impacting the outcome of the patient? And here you have to link it also, again, with toxicity, quality of life, surgical complications, etc. So this is where the field is. At this point in time, I agree that FOLFIRINOX probably is the more favored one. The other issue with neoadjuvant treatment is whether you use radiation or not. We don't use radiation in our neoadjuvant treatment for patients who have resectable disease, but we include radiation in patients who have borderline resectable disease. And again, that's also a research question because the current intergroup trial is looking whether we need radiation in that situation. The reasoning behind using radiation therapy is the fact that in borderline resectable patients, because of the way I describe the anatomy and because the way the surgeon does the resection, especially in the posterior margin of the resection, there is more chance for leaving an R1 resection. And the use of radiotherapy is used not so much to shrink the tumor down. In fact, it's unlikely to shrink the tumor down. It's mostly to sterilize the margins prior to doing the surgery so that you end up with an R0 resection.
So let's talk a little bit about second-line therapy. We asked as a poll question to the audience what they usually use second-line after gem, nab-paclitaxel, and the most common answer was NALIRI 5-FU leucovorin. How do you think through second-line therapy in those patients, and what about the patients who get FOLFIRINOX first-line?
So the majority of the patients still get a gemcitabine-based therapy in the front-line, and a fair number of those patients, as you know nowadays, or an increasing number, would be getting gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel. This is all based on the performance status, comorbidities in the front-line, which really means that most patients cannot get the FOLFIRINOX. So when you're done with the gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, when you go to second-line treatment, there are several considerations. Number one, neuropathy. So if the patient has neuropathy from the gem nab-paclitaxel, then obviously you can't go back and use a platinum like oxaliplatin in the second-line. But really, the most important consideration here is what is the evidence out there? What sort of evidence do we have for second-line therapy after a gemcitabine-based treatment? For a while, we were using a lot of oxaliplatin-based treatment, FOLFOX or OFF, which is the European regimen. However, especially with FOLFOX, which is the regimen preferred in the United States, after a while, we had results which were conflicting results based on one trial which may have favored the oxaliplatin-based use in a different way. But then the Canadian trial came, and it showed that, in fact, FOLFOX in the second line was not better. In fact, it was worse than the control arm, which was 5-FU alone. So based on that, and based on the fact that neuropathy is a factor in choosing the second line, and also based on the information from the NALIRI trial, which is NALIRI 5-FU versus 5-FU alone, which is a phase 3 trial, randomized phase 3 trial that was positive, met its primary endpoint, which provides a level 1 evidence. At this time, I think more people have, including myself, we've been using the NALIRI plus 5-FU as a second line treatment. In fact, if you use it second line, you still have the option of using oxaliplatin-based treatment in the third line. So it becomes more like a doublet in series. If you would, like you have gemcitabine front line, you go to the NALIRI 5-FU in the second line, and then if the patient can make it to the third line, you can come back with an oxaliplatin plus 5-FU, hoping that even if they had neuropathy, that neuropathy had improved by then. But most patients, unfortunately, do not get into third line.
Could you talk a little bit about your experience with NALIRI 5-FU in terms of tolerability and efficacy?
So in terms of the tolerability of the treatment, we more or less are able to get patients through the treatment, but then again, we do the following things. In most patients, I would still start with the full dose that's recommended, which is 70 milligrams per meter squared of the NALIRI. However, I also start with lower dose, like 50 milligrams per meter squared in patients who I feel that they need the dose reduction. For example, patients who've had a lot of problems in the front line, patients who've had radiation treatment as part of their treatment prior to getting the NALIRI, patients who are older. So I really use judgment here. So I don't start everyone with the 70 milligrams per meter squared. I also do the UGT1A1, which can give me an indication of how to reduce the dose of the irinotecan in patients who have the Gilbert syndrome. Now, the side effects that we see with this treatment are what we expect with a regimen which includes irinotecan and 5-FU, although in some ways I have been seeing less side effects than I would expect, and it's partly because the way I have been dealing with their side effects, being more proactive in terms of the diarrhea, I don't really see much in the way of neutropenic complications. If anything, it's going to be the diarrhea and also the nausea, the vomiting, hair loss, and we've been managing them relatively well. In terms of efficacy, as you recall, the Napoli 1 phase 3 trial showed that the combination doubled the progression-free survival and also improved the overall survival. The median overall survival was improved by approximately 2 months, maybe just under 2 months. So overall, it's a regimen that has been well-tolerated, and there have been updates on its efficacy, and again, confirming that it's an active regimen in the second line. Certainly, I see more of disease stabilization, and I see big reductions in the size of the tumor. But I've had patients who've been on it for a good number of months. Again, we try to be very careful in the dose reductions when necessary and closely monitoring the toxicity of the regimen, seeing the patients maybe more frequently to start off with, especially the older patients who go on it.
One of the people in the audience asked the question, could you compare NALIRI-5-FU-LEUKO-VORN to FOLFIRI?
So no one has really done a study to do a head-to-head comparison. The idea of the NALIRI or the non-liposomal irinotecan is that the way the pharmacokinetics and the pharmacodynamics of the drug go is that it's retained in the tumor longer, the tumor environment. And it's a long discussion about this. However, what it really means is that the exposure of the tumor is more efficient exposure of the tumor to the drug, to the active drug, and also the active metabolite. Having said that, I mean, you can see the proof because you're using a lower dose of the drug than the irinotecan and the FOLFIRI. The side effects are probably, the quality of the side effects will be similar, but the intensity of the side effects, from my experience, we're seeing less side effects than the FOLFIRI. Now, in terms of efficacy, I'm not sure if it's going to be much different or any different, although at least based on the experimental evidence, it's a better drug than the straightforward irinotecan. And there will not be any study to compare them head-to-head, but at this point in time, based on what we have known about the use of FOLFIRI and irinotecan in this disease, there is evidence based on that NALIRI works better than the irinotecan. Again, there might be other studies in the future that we will have with FOLFIRI. It may shed more light about the differences between the two, but biochemically speaking, biologically speaking, it is a better drug when it comes to tumor exposure to the active cytotoxic moiety.
I'll ask you a few questions about new directions in the treatment of pancreatic cancer. And one that we actually asked the audience about, we said, should patients with metastatic pancreatic cancer be tested for BRCA, germline, and or somatic mutations?
So in my practice, I routinely do genomic profiling on the patients with stage 4 pancreatic cancer who are embarking on treatment. And one of the reasons is the BRCA. In fact, that's a major reason. BRCA mutations, germline, and also some somatic, when you add to that, can make up to 8-9% of the patients. But also the percentage varies in which location you are in the United States for other reasons. The other thing you can find from the genomic profiling would be the MSI high, which will be 1-2% of the patients only. So patients have BRCA mutations. At this point in time, I do not start with a PARP inhibitor right away. In fact, I do start with a platinum compound. So platinum compound, you can make an argument for FOLFIRINOX, or you can also discuss the use of cisplatin itself, and I have experience with both. And the data so far have indicated that if you use a platinum compound, you have a very good, and not only good as in prolonged, but also a deep response to chemotherapy with the use of a platinum compound. And Eileen O'Reilly published her work using gemcitabine and cisplatin. Now, I do not use the PARP inhibitor up front. The way I use the PARP inhibitor, and I have a patient now who's been on it for many months, is when they get the induction chemotherapy, let's say with the gemcitabine and cisplatin, they have a very good response. And then after a while, in the patient I have, the most recent one, after actually 4 months of treatment, because he was a physician who wanted to go back to work, I switched him to olaparib, which is one of the PARP inhibitors. Again, at this point in time, I don't have a choice of one drug. It depends on which drug I can put my hands on, and the patient is being maintained on it. As we speak, there are trials looking at both, looking at the value of adding a PARP inhibitor to the chemotherapy from day one. Also, there's an international trial called POLO trial, which is looking at induction chemotherapy with a platinum compound, and then once the patient is stable disease or better, then they can be maintained on a PARP inhibitor. Of course, we don't know how long we have to maintain them. At this point in time, we don't. But in my patient, I'm going to maintain the patient for as long as the patient has no evidence of disease progression.
So one other new approach I'd like to hear your thoughts on, and that's the idea of stem cell inhibitors and the first-in-class agent napobucosin. I asked Axel about this, but I also wanted your take. What do we know about stem cell inhibitors and pancreatic cancer? Tony Saab had a presentation at the ESMO World GI Congress looking at napobucosin with nab-paclitaxel and gemcitabine. Can you talk a little bit about the idea behind this treatment strategy and what we know about it?
So pancreatic stem cells, or cancer stem cells in general, have been always a target that we wanted to go after, but the issue is developing the right drug to do that. And there have been attempts to use other agents. So far, we haven't been successful. Napobucosin is a newer drug that targets the signaling pathway, which is a STAT3. And the signaling pathway, STAT3, is not only in stem cells, but the one in stem cells is critical in terms of arresting their growth and even causing apoptosis. And there is ample preclinical work to support the development of this class of agents. And napobucosin has been tested in combination with gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. That was a study that was completed, and you're right, it was presented by Dr. Saab. I was there when he did that last year in Barcelona. And that trial showed a significant improvement in the progression-free survival, which is really the basis of interest to develop the drug further. The combination was relatively well-tolerated, maybe some additional fatigue and GI side effects, but otherwise it was a reasonably well-tolerated combination. At this point in time, we have a large randomized phase 3 trial, which includes more than 1,100 patients, and currently it's underway. So we hopefully, within the next couple of years, will know more about this drug and how it really will be helping our patients. So if we can block the stem cells, the idea here is that we will be able, with chemotherapy, to clear as much as we can from the tumor cells, and then the stem cells, which are the problem in terms of regeneration, if we try to really get rid of them, we may be able to get the patients into a remission for a longer time.
So let's talk a little bit about hepatocellular carcinoma. And we asked a pretty straightforward question of the audience, which is, what's their usual first-line therapy, assuming the patient has good hepatic function? And while the vast majority of the audience still says sorafenib, there were a number of people, including one investigator, who said they'd like to, and this was regulatory issues aside, start out with a checkpoint inhibitor. What's your usual first-line therapy for HCC? And if you could use a checkpoint inhibitor first-line, would you do it?
So my first-line use of treatment, it's still sorafenib. At this point in time, I am not really convinced myself that I would like to jump into a checkpoint inhibitor as a front-line, unless I have some more data in terms of its benefit relative to sorafenib. And I'm saying this not only meaning sorafenib, but also there's another drug, which is lenvatinib. As you know, it showed activity in this disease in a non-inferiority trial versus sorafenib. It also had a longer progression-free survival and probably was better tolerated than sorafenib. So I'm not sure at this time I would replace either of these two drugs with a checkpoint inhibitor for frontline treatment. That is something open for discussion, and I'm not as yet convinced that it has to be a checkpoint inhibitor frontline.
That actually is my next question, because that was an answer given by a number of the audience, lenvatinib. Can you talk a little bit more about what we know about that agent compared to sorafenib? And if you could use both, how do you decide between them?
So it's also a multi-kinase targeting agent. It does appear to be having less in terms of toxicity than sorafenib. And as I mentioned in the non-inferiority trial, large trial, it showed that in terms of survival, it's not any worse than sorafenib, but the progression-free survival was improved. And my reading of the tolerance is also, it looks to be better. So there's a possibility that if it's available, it will start to replace some use of the sorafenib. I would like to use more of it if I have the ability to do so, because my experience with sorafenib has been, and again, the patients we treat with HCC with sorafenib are not exactly the patients we treat or were treated in the SHARP trial, for example, because we treat patients who are a bit beyond the conditions of that trial. Again, it will be interesting to see whether lenvatinib will fit better those patients who are borderline performance status, borderline Child-Pugh classification.
So let's talk a little bit about second-line therapy. Can you review what some of the options are that you consider
Obviously, we have regorafenib now that's a consideration. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the data we have there, as well as checkpoint inhibitors.
So the second line space is becoming crowded. And again, we have regorafenib, which was tested against a placebo in patients who failed the sorafenib. And there was a benefit in terms of the progression-free survival and also overall survival. So that became sort of a standard treatment. But at the same time, we have the checkpoint inhibitors, as you mentioned. So these will be other options that we have that we can use in the second line setting. The third option would be cabozantinib, which you know was also positive in a phase 3 trial. So that would be also an availability, but it's not approved by FDA yet. The fourth one would be ramucirumab, which is the drug we use in colorectal cancer and also in patients with advanced gastric cancer. And that drug is a VEGFR2 monoclonal antibody given every 2 weeks, so it has some sort of convenience. And that drug also has been shown in the recent presentation in ASCO that in patients who have HCC and an AFP level of over 400, those patients benefited from ramucirumab and is relatively well tolerated. So in a short period of time, we will have probably four options in the second line therapy: regorafenib, immune checkpoint inhibitor, we will have also the cabozantinib possibly, and also ramucirumab. Certainly the ramucirumab and the cabozantinib are not FDA approved at this point in time, but they may be. So it will be an interesting way of trying to choose which one to use in different patients.
Can you talk a little bit about dosing if you are going to use regorafenib? Obviously, there's been a lot of development in that area when it's been used in the colorectal cancer setting. They use full dose, but these were people who were coming off sorafenib and presumably tolerating it well. If you have a patient who's coming off sorafenib and they were able to tolerate it, what kind of dose do you use for regorafenib?
In my practice, with the type of patients I treat, I do not exceed 120 milligrams as a starting dose. And I'm aware of the data Dr. Saab presented, starting with the lower dose in patients with colorectal cancer and building up the dose. I do 120 milligrams, but there will be patients who I will do 80 in HCC because of, again, their overall health condition and built up the dose. I personally still struggle with the full dose of the regorafenib, whether it's in colorectal cancer or in HCC.
You mentioned cabozantinib. Can you talk a little bit about your, I don't know if you have any experience with the drug and how it's tolerated?
I haven't used it, but based on the data presented by Dr. Abu Alfa, it appears to be relatively well tolerated, but I haven't used it myself.
Can you talk a little bit about the data we have right now on checkpoint inhibitors in HCC?
As you remember, the study that was done a while back with the nivolumab, and it was a pilot trial, and it had multiple arms. And in that trial, there was evidence that nivolumab has activity in a proportion of patients. Again, we're not talking about a large number of patients, but probably in the region of 15 to 20%. And this was accompanied by, in patients who had response, it was a durable response. The patient's response was maintained for a good number of months and even longer. And it was relatively well tolerated. The other thing is that in that trial, they didn't see much difference in the response based on the etiology of the HCC. And as you know, that got approval by the FDA. And so that's how we have an option in the second line. There's also evidence that pembrolizumab has activity in this disease, as I would expect, being similar molecules and targeting a similar target within the immune system. So that's another option for the patients, is the pembrolizumab.
And have you yourself observed any useful responses to checkpoint inhibitors with HCC?
Yeah, I mean, currently I have a patient who's getting pembrolizumab, and he's been on it for, I would say, close to 2 years. And he's getting, as part of the clinical trial that he started approximately 18 months or 2 years ago. And again, it's a response that has been maintained for quite a long time. So to me, it's impressive, but the issue is, how do we know which patients are going to have such a response? And for that reason, if I knew that better, I probably would have used it in the front line in patients, but I don't have that knowledge. This patient got it as a second line after failure of sorafenib. And I'm just giving you at least one recent experience I had, because I saw the patient recently in the clinic.
So another question from the audience relates to systemic therapy of patients with advanced liver disease, poor liver function. How do you use TKIs how to use systemic therapy in HCC in the patient who has compromised liver function from cirrhosis.
So the use of the TKIs in patients who have Child's-Pugh classification like B, especially beyond B7, really we don't have literature evidence of any safety data because people haven't done studies specifically looking in those patients. So if I have to treat a patient, it will be the use of a lower dose of the drug, as I indicated earlier. If it's a sorafenib or a regorafenib, I will start with a lower dose. I will start with half dose maybe. But my experience has been in patients who have poor liver function and you're giving them TKIs, they really don't do well, whatever you do. So you are treating two diseases. One is the cancer, one is the cirrhosis. And if the cirrhosis is that bad, patients really aren't going to do well on these doses of even the lower doses of the TKIs. Sometimes when the patients have poor liver function and there is a lot of symptoms, I have seen colleagues who have used FOLFOX, believe it or not. FOLFOX is a regimen that we use in metastatic colorectal cancer who have liver metastases and abnormal liver function test. And FOLFOX appears to be, I wouldn't say well-tolerated just like that, but it's simply different than giving a TKI. So that's something which one may consider giving chemotherapy. Now, FOLFOX is rarely used, very infrequently used in this country, but there is evidence for its use in China and other places. So that would be one option in someone who you're afraid, or we are afraid of giving either sorafenib or regorafenib, especially with regorafenib, which can affect the liver function further.
So another question from the audience relates to your use of local therapy in the liver, including TACE. What specific types of approaches do you like to see used in your patients, and when do you use them?
So the hepatic artery-directed therapies, and there are at least three of them. So you have the bland embolization, you have TACE, and you have the radioembolization. No one has done a head-to-head comparison to see which one is better or which one is better tolerated. But in my experience, radioembolization is my preferred option. Also because I can use it if you have vessel obstruction, it's probably the preferred way of doing it rather than using TACE when I say vessel portal vein obstruction or occlusion. So radioembolization does appear to be preferred in that situation. The liver-directed therapy, again, sometimes can be overused, and I've seen patients who have very advanced disease and you do liver-directed therapy. The risk with it is also that you can push the patient into liver failure. That doesn't happen often, but it can happen if you have someone who's really very advanced and also with poor performance status. The studies that have been done looking at survival benefit with liver-directed therapy, there aren't really that many studies done looking specifically at the question whether it really helps the patients in terms of survival. But again, the information that's out there in the literature really indicate that the people who are going to benefit from it are the ones who have relatively good liver function and relatively good performance status. So it comes down to in someone with HCC who has really poor liver function and poor performance status, I'm not sure if we have any treatment at this point in time which I can recommend that is going to make a big difference to the patient. And it makes sense because if you have someone whose liver is too bad, you know, and whatever you do carries the risk of changing the balance into a rapid deterioration of the whole patient.
So you mentioned ramucirumab and HCC. Can you talk a little bit more about what we know about that and also what we learned in the past in terms of bevacizumab?
So one of the things which may be a bit surprising is that bevacizumab didn't show as much of a benefit. We didn't see really a good strong signal there, which really killed the further development of bevacizumab in that setting. Whereas sorafenib, for example, which is VEGFR2 inhibitor, had benefit. Moving forward with ramucirumab is a VEGFR2 receptor monoclonal antibody blocker. And the trial that was done in all comers, as you remember, although it showed some improvement in progression-free survival, the primary endpoint, the survival, wasn't really helped. But then a sub-analysis found that AFP400 was a group who benefited from it. And they went back and did the phase 3 trial that Andrew Zhu presented in ASCO. And here you see a benefit from the ramucirumab, but even then, the benefit is not like a spectacular benefit. It really improves survival by approximately 2 months. So there is improvement, but it's not really a huge benefit. So overall, the anti-VEGF treatments, including the tyrosine kinase inhibitors that target VEGFR2, have some modest benefit. It's not a huge benefit, but it's enough to be a treatment option to be offered to patients. The ramucirumab is interesting. The question is, how do we compare it to other second-line options, although it has a niche only in the patients who have over 400 of AFP?
Yeah, that was really interesting. I guess I was just presented the REACH2 study that Dr. Zhu presented at ASCO. So just thinking about these two diseases, pancreatic cancer first, any approaches that you're particularly excited about in either one of these cancers in terms of new research directions?
So for the pancreatic cancer, the BRCA is only the beginning of what we call going after DNA repair defects. DNA repair defects have been shown in the major genomic studies to be responsible for maybe 10 to 12, 13, 14% of the patients. And understanding those defects beyond just BRCA1 and 2 will result in better treatments in that segment of patients. So that's something which will expand, but we're limited somehow by biomarkers that we can use to identify those patients. And that's the research that has to really be more developed. And it's underway. And linked to that, we're also trying in pancreatic cancer to develop subclassifications which are more functional, more clinically relevant, and that will be underway. In terms of targets in pancreatic cancer, philosophically, we have now moved into a different phase of target therapies, whereas in the past, we were thinking of one molecule, EGFR, IGF-1R, VEGF-1, VEGF-2, VEGF-3, or things like that. Now we're moving more into the functional aspects of the disease, which makes more sense because the functional aspect has more linkage or correlation with the clinical outcome. So the example we used today, we talked about the targeting BRCA1, BRCA2, DNA repair. It's all based on some clinical correlates that we're working on. EGFR didn't have any clinical correlate. The other thing which is really exciting in pancreatic cancer is looking at the microenvironment, because the area or the neighborhood of the pancreatic cancer cells is really very important in terms of cells, immune cells, myeloid cells, etc., but also the matrix, the proteins, and the other material there. So one approach which is currently of interest to see what will happen in the phase 3 trial is the use of the pegylated PEG-PH20. It's a hyaluronidase recombinant human, which is pegylated. You can give it IV, add it to chemotherapy. And the idea is that when you break the stromal barrier hyaluronan, you might be able to deliver treatment better, get a better outcome. This has been shown in the preclinical models, moved into a pilot phase 2 trial, again showing some promise, and now moved into a phase 3 trial in selected patients for the hyaluronan expression. So that's a trial which I think you have to keep an eye on, and that will take maybe another year or so to get the results or something like that, or 18 months. So that's another area which is of interest. There's one other drug, which is the IL-10, the IL-10 agonist, and that showed some interesting activity in patients with pancreatic cancer when combined with chemotherapy in the second line, and that has gone also into a bigger randomized trial. So that's an area which is of interest, because there you're trying to stimulate or improve the function of the CD8 cells that are really getting into the T cells to try to kill the cancer cells. Another area of interest would be the combinations of drugs for immunotherapy, but at this point in time, we're too early in that, and we don't have any good signals, but people are trying hard to combine things together. They're combining checkpoint inhibitors with vaccines, with radiotherapy, with other drugs. CSF1R, for example, combined with nivolumab was discussed in a meeting and shown that it has some activity in a small number of patients. So there are combinations where people are looking at when they're combining the immunotherapy with other drugs that can modulate the microenvironment and let the checkpoint inhibitor or other drugs to work better.
This concludes our program, and we should note that subsequent to recording this discussion, the combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab was approved for the treatment of patients 12 years of age and older with microsatellite instability high or mismatch repair deficient metastatic colorectal cancer that's progressed following treatment with a fluoropyrimidine, oxaliplatin, and irinotecan. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening.
This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio supplement to a satellite CME symposium on GI cancers held during the recent 2018 ASCO meeting.